The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Frederick Forsyth in conversation with Mark Lawson, was recorded at Cecil Sharp House, London, in October 2015. Hosting the event, The Guardian's Mark Lawson.
Good evening. I'm Mark Lawson. As I said, this is Frederick Forsyth, more importantly. We are going to talk between ourselves about The Outsider, My Life and Intrigue, his autobiography, and obviously we'll touch on other books, and then we'll bring some lights up, and you can ask whatever questions you would like to. It has the pace of his fiction books and the fascination. Some extraordinary scenes as well. For example, al fresco sex with a young woman who turns out to be an East German agent who has been following him. We'll talk about some of these scenes, perhaps not all of them. And then portraits of East Germany, France, Africa during Biafran War, and the way in which those then led into his fiction. Various scrapes. I want to talk about this in a moment, but there are several times when you almost died in your life, and it's one of the extraordinary things. We will discuss that trait. First of all, 20 or so books, 15 of them have "the" as the first word. This is, it's something you like, I think.
I don't know why. Yes, yes, it is. I hadn't even noticed that. Extraordinary. There are two or three which is a monosyllable.
Yes.
One word.
Icon Avenger. You could have had The Avenger, couldn't you?
Could have had The Avenger.
No, it sounds like the TV program, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know why. I knocked the "the" off then.
But generally, The Day of the Jackal, The Odessophile, The Dogs of War, The Shepherd, The Devil's Alternative, The Fourth Protocol, The Negotiator, The Deceiver, The Fist of God, The Phantom of Manhattan, The Veteran, The Afghan, The Cobra, The Kill List, The Outsider, The Biafran War. So it's pretty much all of them.
Yes.
But it has a sort of emphatic quality, hasn't it?
It may be, yes. I don't know why I do it. Most of them would survive without the definite article. But I just think that way.
And you explain in the book the moment where you finish typing The Day of the Jackal after 35 days, and it's called The Jackal at that point.
It was originally The Jackal. And I was sitting totally impoverished, absolutely broke, in a little flat, not even mine, in Chelsea. And there it was, and I just mulled it over, and I thought maybe someone will think it's a sort of documentary about an African animal. So I rolled the first page back into the typewriter, obviously, and typed the words "the day of" in front. And it's never been changed since. I mean, not just the title, but the entire book. It's the what you read today, if at all, is in fact the original manuscript. So it must have got something right.
No, and I wondered about that because your style, you've been a journalist for a lot of your life, so you know about writing to length, but the books as well, very economical, pacey. Some writers we know, they write 800 pages and the publishers get it down to 400, but do you generally, even with books, do you generally write, is this it, generally, the
manuscript? Yeah, I don't do second drafts. I certainly, unlike Geoffrey, I don't do 17 drafts.
Geoffrey Archer.
I don't know how he does them, but anyway, but then he told me once that he gets to the bottom of the first page and he doesn't know what's going to happen on the second. Now, I can't understand how he could work that way, but he does. Others don't know the ending of the story when they begin. I couldn't think how to work that way. But yes, everything is fairly economical with words because that is journalistic style. So if you say, what is your literary style? There isn't one. It's not literary. It's a style, but it's basically a long dispatch.
And short sentences, that's your... you vary them, but a lot of short sentences.
Yes, okay. Reasonably short sentences. Not too long, and no frills, no furbelows, no bells. It's just basically trying to say what happens. I long thought that I'm really more a storyteller than anything. So for me, the story is about 80%, the plot is about 80% of what I write, rammed into the other 20% as the style, character development. They've often been referred to as cardboard cutout figures, wouldn't dispute that. Descriptive passages and dialogue, all five, get into 20%. 80% is the story, the story, the story. That's why I don't do really love affairs, because they're diversions. And I don't see the point of taking hero and heroine, or just bird, away to a weekend in a country and coming back on the Monday morning when the reader said, I forgot what the hell was happening. So unless it's absolutely crucial to the plot, leave it out. And you put that sentence into every chapter and it pares it down to a manageable length.
And you say, you think of yourself as a storyteller. I would say, having read the book, reporter, because it seems to me that your newspaper work and your books, it's the same thing. There's a chapter in the book where your first mentor in journalism, great advice for all people who want to be journalists, find out everything you can, check it, and then start writing. But that's really what you do with the fiction as well.
Yeah, that was Frank Keeler, and continued in Reuters. Reuters also a very spare style. Tell it the way it was, tell them what happened. Again, no frills, just, and above all, no inaccuracies. And the only way to keep them out is just keep checking. Even when you think you're convinced you know it, check. You probably got it wrong. Memory is not good. Most people isn't very good anyway. So, yes, keep checking. And I suppose it is like a reportorial style. I won't change now. I haven't changed for 45 years. I'm not going to change now.
Well, but if we believe what you say in this book at the end, you're not going to have to change because you say this is your last book.
That's one song, yeah.
I just add a caveat here, which is that I've interviewed Miss Forsyth over a number of years, and we've done... This would be our third final interview because he's retired twice during previous interviews.
Well,
but
yes.
This really is it's like Frank Sinatra. This is the absolute farewell tour.
I hope it is. I really do believe it is because I have nothing else to write that I want, really. More to the point, I found with the last novel, which was The Kill List, the world is getting very, very technologically complex and I can't understand half of it. So for the passages in the Kill List that involved what's called cyberspace and cyber technology, I didn't know how this worked, that worked. So I went to a company who handled most of the computer work for the MOD. My managing director, who was what I call a normal human being, and he said, well, I don't know. I'll bring in some of my specialists. Two nice young men came in, probably mid-20s, and I asked them a question, and they gave me the answer, and I couldn't understand a word they were talking about. Absolutely, you might as well be talking in ancient Greek. So I said this, and they looked at me as if I was the defective one, which they probably convinced I was. And I said, can you explain it to me in layman's language? And the answer simply is, no, we can't. It's just, this is the way we talk. And so we did eventually, we worked out what they were trying to tell me and how this particular gizmo worked up somewhere up in space or in cyberspace. Because I thought, I'm going to have to explain it to the nice old lady in Leicester, or not. And if I can't understand it, she won't understand it. So I've got to bring it down from hyper-tech to normal layman's language. And by the end of the Kill List, I thought, I can't do this anymore because I just do not know what's going on. what GCHQ at Cheltenham are doing, the way they're listening to a snatched conversation in the middle of the Yemen, the idea of an American senior NCO sitting in a booth in Creech, Nevada, which is American Air Force Base just outside Las Vegas, with a screen in front of him and watching, looking down at the North Yemen desert with a control column in his hand, and he's steering a two-winged monster, which has no pilot, obviously, but does have two Hellfire missiles under its wings, over a land desert. And there, somewhere down there, there is a sort of black land cruiser in it with a top ISIL man in it. And if a positive ID is made, then he will launch. And there's a puff of smoke, unperceived by anybody but him, in the middle of nowhere, and that is the end of yet another ISIL-serving terrorist. But how it's done, I just don't know. I can't explain how it's done, but it is done. And it's weird. It's a new warfare form that's beyond me. And it's also past me. You know, I'm another generation, probably past it.
And one solution for that, for many writers feel that as they get older, they don't understand the world, so they write historical fiction. With the odd exception of your of Day of the Jackal and the Odessophile, which were either wholly or in effect set in the past, but since then you've written pretty much up to the moment, haven't you?
Yeah, mostly contemporaneous. Jackal was written in about 63. Yes, Odessa was written. It was the night Kennedy died in November 63, and that begins with the death of Kennedy. So, and that was written in 71, so about a decade. And then I came closer to now, 2 or 3 years old. I mean, I did, I think, The Fist of God, which was the first Iraq war in 94, and of course it ended in 91. So I find contemporary easier to cope with. I'm certainly not going back to Richard the Lionheart.
It's a very unusual memoir, The Outside of My Life and Intrigue, because, as you know, there's a whole genre of the misery memoir. They even have, I don't think they actually call them that in bookshops, but there are whole shelves of people, terrible childhoods. This is very different. This is a book about having good parents and good luck, largely.
Yeah, I did. Both. You're quite right. As you see it in the Sunday tabloids, you know, I was brutalized, I was beaten, I was abused. That's bad enough. I think it's even worse when the brothers and sisters come and say, "No, you weren't. You know, we have wonderful parents. What are you talking about?" It's all this, you know, pity me. Well, don't pity me. I had a good life. I had a lot of luck. As you mentioned a couple of times, I got out of scrapes that I should not have got into. But I also had a good start in life, a good parents. And so I would never, you know, look back and say, "Hey, you know, you came out of nowhere and you clawed your way up." But I didn't. I was a son of shopkeepers, comfortable, middle class, in education, in a little town in Kent called Ashford. So it couldn't have been more ordinary. Certainly wasn't miserable.
Except that one of the things that I do a lot of interviews with writers is how the pieces of luck you have, even where you come from, how it shapes the material. I mean, the fact you grew up in Kent, because that was, I mean, literally so close to the war, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in 1940 to 1945, first we had obviously the threat of invasion in 40, which I knew nothing about. I was 2 years old. And then the Normandy invasion in 44. And then, but that was just seeing the soldiers departing. Although I mentioned it in the book, of course, Kent was not the launch point. But what?
But it's an amazing scene in the book because there are all these soldiers in Kent, yeah. And they thought they were. They thought they were going to die, and they weren't. They were the decoys.
This was the great deception of trying to persuade Hitler that we were going over at the Pas-de-Calais, and so East Kent was stuffed with quite a sizable army, which was very visible, deliberately visible. Whereas a lot of the tanks actually were cardboard. And we didn't know that. It was very secret. But, of course, the reason was that the real forces were being massed down near Portsmouth. But the soldiers concerned thought they were going, so they thought they were going to take horrendous casualties trying to break through the Atlantic Wall at the Pas-de-Calais. So they were going to go out on a last bender. So much of East Kent was smashed up. And then, of course, it happened, you know, 6th of June, but not there, down in leaving Portsmouth for Normandy. And then they all moved off to join the forces in Normandy. And that was the last we saw them. Then came the Doodlebugs. Not so much the V2s, they were a bit too late, but the Doodlebugs, which ran out of fuel, often well short of London, and crashed onto Kent. So all through that period, I was there. Now, most of the kids of Ashford actually were evacuated. My parents decided to keep me with them, except for the Battle of Britain, which I missed, not that I would recognise it anyway. But I was sent to Devon for that. But then they recalled me. And so we lived as a contented threesome for the whole of that war in Kent. And I remember it with affection.
But the brief period when you were evacuated, well, evacuated in two senses, because it's an amazing revelation, this. You perhaps had your nappy changed more than any other child in the history of the world. That got them set up.
I don't know about the world. That does deserve an explanation. It wasn't that I had a particularly sensitive rear end. It was rather that there was an institute called the Norland Institute, which trains the Great British Nanny and has done for well over 100 years. And the Great British Nanny has educated emirs and sultans and maharajas and God knows what. And they were based just outside Ashford. And they evacuated during the war, during the Battle of Britain, when it looked as if Jerry was coming any time, about April maybe, 1940. Dunkirk was early May, I think. Anyway, when the boys came back from Dunkirk, it was presumed that the German army would be hot on their heels. And so the Norland Institute evacuated. Now, the principal of the Norland Institute used to frequent my mother's dress shop. And my mother said, would you take little Freddie with you? And she said, well, actually, we're going to need a few guinea pigs to practice on. So I was taken down to Devon. And these young trainee nannies needed to be taught how to change a baby, even if he wasn't wet. So I got changed and changed and changed and changed. And eventually, I think I probably was in receipt of more talcum powder than any other child in the kingdom. It could be that that persuaded my mother to bring me back to Ashford, where I'd be changed only probably once a day.
And do you, it's an obvious question, do you think it's affected you?
No.
You have a thing about talcum powder, don't you?
No. I made a lighthearted remark about
it. You can't resist the talcum powder joke.
About talcum powder.
And then another thing that shaped your life hugely, I think, is that languages, the languages you acquired when you were young. At various points in this book, I mean, we'll give you English, which obviously was your birth tongue, but at various points of the book you learn German, French, Spanish, Russian, and Royal Air Force lingo. So that's...
that order.
Yeah, so that's five... five languages.
Well, so, I don't know if the RAF's got a lingo of its own. Slang.
It's a slang. Yeah.
But it's only for technical matters, I think.
No, but brought up. When someone's sick in the book, you always say brought up and that, and folding stuff for money. That's all RAF.
Is it? I suppose so.
Yeah.
It was imbibed then without my recognising that this was a lingo of its own. It was just the slang of the time.
But the others... there's a fascinating little paragraph where you talk about the importance when you learn a language, that it's not just knowing the learning academically, the vocabulary and the grammar. Well, you explain, but you have to do something else.
You can learn a language to a functional point with just basically vocabulary and grammar. But if you're ever going to try and pass for a native of that language in its own, among others, there are three extras you have to have. One is obviously accent. The British have an appalling reputation for speaking with the most strangulated accent, no matter what. Whether it's from French to Hindi, we just don't seem to master languages in terms of the phonetics. The only way, really, is to be a child in a family that speaks that language. And then you will imbibe, unwittingly, the inflections. The nasal French sound, which is like EN or something, and the German "ch" sound in the back of the throat, which is, you know, the same as the Scots. Any Scots present, you'll know what a loch is. Not, my father always called it a lock. He could not say loch. But you need the CH sound in German, for example. But then on the fourth position, I would say it's certainly the slang. We all use it without realizing we use it. Say, you're pulling my leg. You can't say that in French. On tire la jambe. No, you do not. You met en boîte. You put him in a box. It's a different slang. And I don't think we realize really how many phrases we use in the course of any conversation, which are not probably in the dictionary. And the last thing is body language, is gestures. If you see a Frenchman talking, Italian talking, they do actually use the body much more than we do. We can sit and talk with, like I am, with immobile hands. An Israeli can't do that. An Italian can't do that. So if you've got them all five, then yes, you might pass for a German among Germans or a Frenchman among French.
And you were able to do that. You were.
Well, again, it's being a child. I was sent to France to spend the whole of the long summer hole. If you've got kids, you know about the long summer hole. What the hell do you do with them? Well, my parents had a shop to run. Both of them ran the shop, and that was their heavy period, summer. So the eight-week summer hole, what to do with Freddie? And then they got this introduction to a French family who said, send him to us. We have a country house in the middle of France, you know, and we'd love to have him. So first, and then that was when I was 9, and then 10, 11, 12. By the end of 12, I could pass a French boy among French boys. And then my dad said, I think we should do the same with German. Obviously, because of the French, I'd entered the modern language block at school, so German was the next. So I had sort of a first few lessons in German at school. But then he found a German family, and I did the same for the next 3 years. And by 16, I could pass for German. And it is just simply absorbing. Kids will absorb anything. I mean, and probably never to be repeated. You could get a Berlitz school or whatever and study a language till you're blue in the face, but you will never be as good as if you'd started at 10 and lived with a family of that language for even 3 months. It'll do it. And it doesn't leave you.
I wondered about that. So of the languages, how many do you still have?
Well, basically, the three. I mean, the Russian's just gone. It was always a conversational, but it's too many years without speaking a word of it, gone. But I was over in Germany recently, and it's always the same when I go for a promotion of this book. First day is rusty, second day is halting, third day it's getting back brilliant, then I'm on the plane home. but
you do, the Germans are rather surprised. So in France and Germany, you do the... And Spain, you do the interviews in that language.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Germans are rather surprised because I was on a four-guest program with the moderator and the four guests. And he went round 1, 2, 3, and I was number 4. And then he asked the question in German. There was an audience like this, and they assumed the interpreter would walk onto the stage and sit at my elbow. But he didn't, so I replied. And it was like wind blowing on a cornfield. Um Gottes Willen, der spricht Deutsch. So, yes, sorry, chaps.
But it shaped your life hugely, as we can see, because that's it was instrumental in your becoming a foreign correspondent, and then what you experienced as a foreign correspondent led directly to the first few novels.
Yeah, it was like tripping dominoes. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. I got into Reuters, but in the London office, until the number 2 in the Paris office had a heart murmur. They put him on the plane home, and a head came around the door and said, I didn't want to hear speak French. Well, yep. So a brief interview with the head of the French desk, Maurice, who had been with de Gaulle in the war and married an English girl and stayed on, and on the morning plane to Paris.
Although I'll just interject, this is a lovely moment because anyone who's worked in newspapers know that people often lie about the languages they have. So and there are notorious cases of people turning up in a country and then only knowing a few phrases. So Maurice was, he was set to test you, basically.
Well, Maurice was sitting tapping away, typewriters in those days, obviously. And the guy who brought me to his desk side said to him, "Does this guy speak French?" Without even looking up, he just said to me in French, "What do you reckon to the situation in Paris at the moment?" Well, I obviously studied it. It was weird because it was May 62. Paris was on the threshold of coup d'etat, practically, and there might have been a revolution. It could have been a civil war. De Gaulle had announced he was going to give independence to Algeria. The OAS had formed. Most of the French Foreign Legion had mutinied at their bases in North Africa. And along with the so-called Pieds Noirs, the Black Feet, meaning the French colonists of North Africa, they had just sentenced him to death. They just decided to assassinate him. There was a very virulent extreme left wing. The Parti Communiste Français was the biggest in Europe. And so the streets of Paris were aflame with marching demonstrations going one way or the other. And it just looked bad. So anyway, I replied. I don't know how long I talked for, but probably no more than 30 seconds. And Maurice stopped typing. And he looked up and he said to the guy, he said, "I've never heard Osbif talk like that." So using the rather derogatory French word for us, Rosbif. I never heard a Rosbif talk like that. So he said, "Right, mate, you're on the morning plane."
And it's extraordinary because you explain this in the book, but people... readers are always fascinated where books, novels come from and where the ideas come from. It's so astonishingly clear in this book. You say De Gaulle basically knew that very well that people were trying to assassinate him, and he also knew that that was why he was always followed by everywhere he went by the press. You were detailed to follow him. And at that point, you did, not as an assassin, but not even as a novelist, but you didn't think you were one, but you just thought, how would they kill him?
I was assigned by Harold King, the bureau chief, to basically follow him around, but I wasn't the only one. There was a corps of about 50 who were following him all the time. Every time he left the Élysée Palace, there was the press corps. He might be going to the Senate, he might be going to some provincial tour, but we were always there, and he knew perfectly well we weren't there for the event. We were there for the bullet hole, straight through the fourth one. And he just raised his big hooter in the air and stalked on, kepi on head, or possibly bareheaded, with the Savile Row suit. The only thing British he'd have about him or near him was a Savile Row suit. He wouldn't have himself tailored anywhere else. But so he would stalk through, surrounded by his bodyguards, and then when he went into the building that he was visiting, the press corps split into two, the English-speaking group and the French-speaking group. And the French-speaking group, obviously, were the Belgians and the Quebecois and the French. The English-speaking group was all the Nordics and the Germans and the Canadians and the Americans and the Brits. But I stayed with the French group. And joining us in the cafe, we always had two different cafes, it wouldn't mix. Joining us in the French-speaking cafe was the four bodyguards, or the two on duty that day. And I was actually amazed at how loose-lipped they were. They let slip procedural secrets, I suppose, which nobody would dream of printing. I mean, we were rather more discreet than we are today. And nobody would dream of giving anything away. But as the months passed, I got formed an impression that the OAS were not going to succeed, that they would fail. And the reason was twofold. One, every single one of them was on file. They knew their faces. If they were soldiers, obviously, they knew their faces. They had their fingerprints. They had their names. They knew all about them. And secondly, they had so deeply, the French counterintelligence forces, so deeply penetrated the OAS that if four OAS men met to plot a killing, one of them was probably on the payroll. So they were done for. And the only thing thing that they might do, thought I, only up here, never told anybody, was bring in an outsider, unknown, no file, no dossier, no mugshot, nothing, no known face, no known name, and a rifle with a scope sight might get through. And I nurtured this idea, never thinking to write it, for 7 years. until finally 1970, skint, back from Biafra, skint, and thinking how to make some money. I thought foolishly, because it's the stupidest way of making money you can dream up, I know, I'll write a novel. And that became the Joe the Jackal.
Although the idea of the jackal, as you say, it more recently has become known, and the phrase, the term appears in some of your later books, the clean skin, but it's that idea, it's someone who is off the radar.
Yeah, also known as a lily white. That's what the NI5 referred to, and the Metropolitan Police Anti-Terrorist Squad referred to young fanatics who are just not on the radar, have never put their head above the parapet, and they don't know who they are. Like these two who killed the drummer, Rigsby. They'd been heard of. In fact, one had been on trial in Kenya, but they weren't regarded as top-level danger men. And then suddenly they were killers. That's called a lily white or a clean skin. And if they'd brought in... but he'd have to have been a professional, not some zany fanatic. He'd have to have been a top professional. He might have got through these concentric rings of security around De Gaulle. And they were good. There's no question about it. They were very good and very ruthless.
And you also, as a foreign correspondent, which led directly to the Odessa file, later you were in East Berlin. And there have been a lot of newspaper headlines, as you know, some of them rather over-egged. Forsyth admits to having been a spy. And so on. It was slightly more... What you were an asset, as they call
but much
it.
Later.
Later, yeah.
When I was a foreign correspondent, I was never approached. And there's a very good reason for that. It's a simple fact that every dictator in the world hates the idea of a free press. They loathe it. So when foreigners come into their country asking what they regard as thoroughly impertinent questions, that person will come under surveillance. There's always a... Every dictatorship has a vicious secret police. I've seen a few of them. The Stasi is in East Germany, clearly. And I was, at the time, after Reuters sent me over there from Paris to East Berlin, the only Western correspondent east of the Wall, for various reasons didn't detain us. But anyway, there was only one permitted agency running an office east of the Wall after the Wall went up, and that was Reuters. It was the only one that was retained. But I was never, ever approached for obvious reasons. Impossible to recruit as anything useful because I was always under surveillance. So the helping out, if you like, came much later. Mm. But there's nothing, let me just make this point, if I can, Mark, there's nothing weird about that. It was the Cold War was on. The Cold War was dangerous. And an awful lot of the strength, if you like, of the British intelligence service was that it had a lot of volunteer helpers. We were quite different, for example, from the French or the German or even the Americans in that sense. The firm, as they call themselves, would sometimes approach a businessman who was going to a trade fair in a difficult-to-get-at city and sort of just say quite gently and with laborious courtesy, would you be so kind? If an envelope came under your hotel door, you know, perhaps just to pop it in the attaché case and bring it home. And the surprisingly large number said, yeah, all right, we'll do. So that was all I did. I ran a couple of errands, but no more than that.
But there are some journalists who think that foreign correspondents think that you shouldn't do that, that it's unethical for a journalist.
Well, you see, I didn't do it as a journalist.
You did it as a
I was The first time I was in Biafra, I was asked not to spy on the Biafrans, but to confirm that the level of the suffering of the children was as being portrayed. There was a row going on at the top of our government. The Foreign Office was saying it was all imaginary and it was all phony and nothing much was happening. Certainly there were hardly any dying children at all. It was all nonsense. We should continue sending torrents of weapons to the Nigerian dictatorship. There was another school of thought that was saying, actually, this isn't working, and it's going to go on and on and on. It's not going to end next week, as the foreigners would like us to believe, sir being Harold Wilson, or possibly Michael Stewart.
And also, crucially, just to interject, but that was the official, which your problem originally you were reporting for, well, not reporting for the BBC, because they didn't want you to report from there.
No.
Because their official line was the Foreign Office line, that it was all a lot of nonsense and would blow over very quickly.
Yeah, and it didn't blow over. And my prognosis was this is not going to be what it was portrayed as at the very outset, which is a sort of rather minor intertribal spat. which prime minister will be suppressed by the marvellous Nigerian Federal Army in 3 to 4 weeks. A year and a half later, the children were dying like flies, and the media had broken the story. But the row still went on at the top end of government between the two schools of thought. We should actually use our influence on Lagos Prime Minister to produce a ceasefire and a peace conference and end this misery. Foreign Office, it's all grossly exaggerated, Prime Minister, and we should continue to pour our efforts and support into Lagos because it will be over very quickly if we do. And strangely enough, the Foreign Office is saying one thing, and although the firm comes under the Foreign Office, it was saying the opposite, saying, no, this is true. And it was just put to me, if we had a man in on the ground, our position would be immensely strengthened in that debate. So I said, well, what do you want me to do? Well, can you confirm that the children are dying in these numbers and likely to go on doing so? I said, yes, I can. Well, not from here, where we were sitting in a ice cream parlour at the time. And he said, no, I mean from inside, right in the heart of it. So I said, yeah. He said, are you going back? I said, yeah. So I went back into the rainforest and reported from there for the last year of the war. It didn't. I mean, the argument wasn't won. It went on for another year, and eventually Biafra was crushed. I think the International Committee of the Red Cross estimated something like 1 million dead children. In my view, they needn't have died. That was what made me angry.
But even now, more than 40 years on, there's an astonishing moral anger in those sections about Biafra, a rage. I mean, you feel that.
Yeah, because it was so unnecessary. I mean, we've all now... Back then, it was the first time that British people had ever seen these images. Now we've seen Michael Burke's documentaries about Eritrea, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and so on. But back then, it was new, and this wasn't a crop failure. This was a deliberately imposed blockade leading to famine with full British support. And that angered me because it was the Nigerian government wasn't democratically elected. It was a brutal dictatorship, albeit behind a fairly agreeable puppet leader called Yakubu Gowon. But the men behind him were hard-line northern fanatics. Whether they did or did not want to exterminate the Igbo people, it certainly looked like it. I don't know how many people you've got to kill before the word genocide crops up, but whatever. I would have thought 1 million children is about right for genocide. And here was my government, for the first time, as far as I could think back in its entire history, actually assisting a brutal military dictatorship to kill its own people. We've never done that before, or since.
And there is a theme that runs through the book, which... To me, it has surprised some people who have read it and written about it. I think it's unfair because I had no reason to think the opposite. But there is a theme running through against anti-Semitism, against racism. I mean, that goes through very strongly in the book, which I suppose has surprised people because some people, as you've written for right-wing publications largely, and you're associated with the right.
I'd like to say centre-right. Conservative economic policies, yes. Because I've seen them work, and I've seen left-wing policies fail worldwide. But I think I take the lead from my father. He was a very kindly man. He was a very tolerant man. And he taught me to hate bigotry, which I do. There are various forms of anti-Semitism. I suppose anti-Muslimism or whatever is another. Homophobia is another. Racism is another. I don't like any of them. So yes, there is a theme in there, which is made it all the more odd that when I was later asked to report back from Smithies, Rhodesia, and apartheid-ridden South Africa, they fell for my purported support for apartheid.
Now, this is another example. It's the firm, as you call the intelligence services. They asked you to do some... listening in South Africa?
Well, I mean, years later, when I was already a fairly well-known author, the cover was superb. An author researching his next book. Nobody can prove you're going to do it. You can go anywhere, ask to meet anybody. They can say no, but very often they didn't. They talk, hopefully, very indiscreetly. You pretend to agree, nod, and take notes, and then report back. But that happened much later. That happened in the 70s in Rhodesia and the 80s in South Africa.
But the key thing, as you say, because of this, that aspect of your image, that you have some people, they assumed you were on their side.
Well, yeah, yeah. I pretended to be. I mean, it's not terribly difficult. They were all, say, white supremacists. And it's odd that they would fall for a guy who clearly went into the rainforest of Biafra to try and help a lot of black people to be a white supremacist. But they did. They swallowed it. And were very, very overt in what they intended to do and how they needed to do it and what their policies were and so on. And that was what apparently was needed back here.
And that the role of pretense, again, that occurs elsewhere in the book, although, as we've established, you have the ability to pass in Germany as a German, in France as a Frenchman. As a journalist, you often wouldn't do that. You talk about your Bertie Wooster act.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, one way of appearing harmless is to appear dim. I use the phrase Bertie Wooster because those of us who've read P.G. Woodhouse will know that Bertie Wooster was a very nice chap. He was amiable and affable and thick as a plank. And that is the image of the rather ineffectual Englishman that is extremely popular in Europe. They love to believe that that's what we are. So if you pretend to be that, the chances are they'll think you're harmless. And if you're harmless, sometimes, on a couple of occasions, I walked out of a police cell because I was presumed to be completely harmless, too stupid to be dangerous.
But also that they will speak their language in front of you, assuming you're incapable of them.
They do that. When I was pretending to be just a thicko, I would speak their language, if at all, very hesitatingly and with much flawed grammar and an appalling accent. So the East Germans certainly thought, well, we'll spot him any time because he can't even begin to look or behave like an East German. And that was when I would just disappear and become an East German. But that wasn't for the fun.
No.
They never came near me.
No, that was in journalism. But again, that astonished me. That so when you would give your mind as the slip in East Germany and you would go off you passed as an East German to East Germans.
Well, yes. Oddly enough, when I got into the heart of East Germany proper, I mean outside the ring around Berlin, there was a ring around Berlin east and west. On the eastern side, there was a ring going from East Berlin into East Germany proper. But I didn't go that way. I went through West Berlin where they couldn't follow me. So through Checkpoint Charlie, in an East German registered car, out the other side into West Berlin, straight through West Berlin and out the other side on the highway to the west, but back into East Germany, and then pull off the first ramp off, disappear. And I once, I approached about five different groups. I was looking for a downed American bomber, which I'd been asked to trace. And I asked a number of people by the roadside, explaining that ich bin von Berlin, I'm from Berlin. And they assumed that I was official and gave me no cooperation whatever until I thought this is the wrong approach. And then, as they were not themselves officialdom, I produced a British passport. Total cooperation. That was how much they loved the Workers' Republic. And they said, there's here the gefallen is down there in that wood over there. And it was. I mean, the wreckage of the bomber. So that was the story. But anyway, it didn't save me from 24 hours interviews with Stasis. But anyway, I got out of that as well.
And the portrait of East Berlin during the Cold War, I mean, anyone who's studying it, I think, should read it. There are amazing details. You were able to pass easily from east to west because, as a journalist, you were allowed to do that. But some of the details you have, all the Soviet satellite countries had a sort of show shop in East Berlin, which would sell caviar.
The Russians did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I had a rather weird experience because before I was sent to East Berlin, I was called in by Jerry Long, who was the managing director of Reuters, and he said, we have a problem. in East Berlin. So I thought, oh dear, yes, what can this be? He said, you see, we have a contract with ADN, the East German News Agency. they pay for our service 20% in hard currency, but 80% in Eastmarks. And the Eastmarks are in a bank in East Berlin, and they're blocked. You can withdraw them and spend them in East Germany, but you can't bring them out. In any case, Eastmarks have no value. They're lavatory paper. So what we want you to do, Freddie, old boy, is go and then try and spend some of our money. So I thought, this is, I've never been asked to spend somebody else's money before. So I thought, I'll do my best.
And they'd stacked up millions of them, haven't they?
Yeah, they had 1.25 million Eastmarks blocked. So I said, well, dear, I'll do what I can. It's obviously going to be a horrible chore. I got into East Berlin and thought, well, what the hell's worth buying anyway? And there were about four articles. There was a Havana shop selling Monte Cristos and Romeo Julietas and some of the rather good stuff. The Americans were banned by the American government from either purchasing or owning Cuban product. But if you happened to be with an American officer and you needed a favor, 24 Monte Cristos went down very nicely indeed. There was a house Moscow and a restaurant Moscow, which had mountains of beluga. Well, I managed to force myself to live off beluga and smoke salmon for quite some time. The other two things were there were Czech classical LPs, were good quality, and Hungarian pigskin luggage was of very good quality. So I sometimes fill up the trunk of the car and take it over to West, send a couple of hundredweight over to West Berlin, flog them off. Well, I was being paid peanuts anyway, so why not?
But you also mentioned the atmosphere in West Berlin at the time, that there was a sort of hysteria, you say, lots of drinking, lots of sex, because, and this leads to one of your most extraordinary stories about how you almost started World War III. But they yeah. did, they were surrounded. Right. I mean, they believed that at any moment.
Well, it was generally believed, yes, apart from the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 62, it was presumed that if World War III started, the trigger could well be West Berlin, East Berlin, West Berlin. Stalin had tried to crush West Berlin, contrary to the four-power agreement of 1945. In 1948, we have to be really long in the tooth to remember the Berlin blockade and the air bridge we set up, bringing in everything, including coke and coal, as well as food and fresh water, to keep West Berlin alive. It lasted nearly a year. And then finally, he relinquished his grip on West Berlin. But the mood of West Berlin was always slightly hysterical. Like we could be invaded within the hour tomorrow morning. If it comes, we'll never know, and it'll be over quite quickly. Despite the fact we had a British garrison, an American garrison, a small French garrison, that certainly they were no match for divisions of armor rolling through the wall. So that was the mood, and it was slightly hysterical. The partying was pretty frantic. Yeah. Frantic. Yeah.
And then the hysteria increased. This is has this for the opening to a chapter. I recall the day when I almost started the Third World War with exact accuracy for reasons that will become plain. It was 24th of April 1964, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was in my car, twisting and turning my way through the coffin dark streets of East Berlin. And you'd been with a charming young member of the state opera chorus.
Which yeah. That was what I was doing at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get home.
This is amazing. You've had many great and accurate scoops in your career as a journalist, but this was but this was a misunderstanding.
This would have been the biggest scoop of them all. I was driving home through streets I didn't know in pitch blackness at 2 a.m. And I just suddenly came across a Russian soldier in a fur shapka standing there with his hand up, meaning the very clear stop. Signal. So I stopped. And then across the intersection, I had this rumbling sound, and then this column after column after column of motorized infantry, bridge building equipment, armor, artillery, armored cars, the lot. So I thought, struth, what the hell are they doing? And they were all rolling towards the wall. I hung a U and went back and tried to find my way through. Another Russian soldier, another. And blocked off crossing, and more armor, more tanks. more artillery, all going towards the wall. So I thought, struth, I think this is it. I think this could be it. Eventually I got back to my apartment and office, and I thought, what the hell do you do? Nobody to confer with, no telephone communication with the West at all, just the telex machine, which didn't reply that way. It only went that way. So I thought, the only thing one can do is just report exactly what I've seen. No interpretations, no attempt at explanation, just simply, this is what is happening here tonight, now, as I write.
The Russian army is on the move.
Yeah. But anyway, so I thought, I wrote it, I don't know about telex machines, but you used to be able to type the whole dispatch and all those little holes in the tape, but not send the tape, and then hit transmit fast mode.
And which was crucial, as you explain in the book, to do that if you were under surveillance, because if you sent it bit by bit, they'd just stop it.
Yeah. So, yeah. What happened again, see, people thought they were incredibly efficient. They weren't. The night staff in the sensors office would be junior. So they would see something coming through that they thought was very iffy, but they would have to check with higher authority first, and he'd have to check with higher authority. And so it could take up to 30, 40 minutes before someone said, "Goodness villain, stop it." And then the machine stopped. And up came Linienstörung, which is line distortion, meaning, you know, the line's gone down, which it hadn't, of course. They'd simply switch it off. But so out of a 20-folio story, I think about 18 through, which went through to West Berlin, on to Bonn, and the night duty man in Bonn must have said something rather obscene, and he passed it on to London, where there was a night staff on, obviously. And they didn't actually put it out on the world service, which is just as well. It would have panicked the entire world. What they did was they got on to a senior Reuter man who woke up, presumably, the night duty officer at the Foreign Office, or maybe the MOD, and said, this is what we're getting through from Berlin, our man in East Berlin. The Soviet army's on the move. I learned later that I'd woken up half the British government. It was about 10 p.m. in Washington. So they woke them up. All these, if they weren't in bed, they were probably having coffee after dinner, coffee, and got them on. Eventually, it was breakfast time in Moscow. Someone raised someone in Moscow and said, what the F are you doing in Berlin? And back came a bewildered, well, we're having the rehearsal for the May Day parade, of course. And that was what it was. That's why I remember the date. It was exactly 7 days before May Day. They had had the previous year, they'd done it in the daytime and snarled up the whole of East Berlin. So they thought, this time we'll do it at 2 a.m. But they didn't tell it. Being communists, they couldn't bother to tell anybody. So, it really did look like they were going straight through the wall and out the other side and into West Berlin. And West Berlin would be stitched up by breakfast.
So as a journalist, as you sat in your flat in East Berlin, you thought you were reporting the Third World War, basically.
It looked like it, yeah. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, it didn't go worldwide. It was suppressed at Whitehall and Washington level. Then it was explained. Then it was killed. You can imagine a veritable tsunami of derision probably fell onto my head. But I say to this day, it wasn't entirely my fault. And it was never mentioned again. It never has been mentioned again until now.
That's the amazing thing, because these days the person who did this would be publicly shamed and have to go into hiding and all that kind of stuff.
But they all fell for it.
Yeah.
They all fell for it.
But
for
there
about
was
an
no,
hour and a half. They all fell for it.
You tell them how. Do you have to, with that, well, that's not a firm story, but the latest story is when the two things you did for the firm. Do you have to ask their permission to write about them now?
In principle, yes.
But in practice, no.
I didn't say that.
But at the time, did you sign the Official Secrets Act?
I believe I must have done. Hmm. Several times, actually. Air Force, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of other instances, and presumably doing jobs, yes.
And we're going to open up to the audience in a moment. But as I mentioned at the beginning, several times in this book, your life is in danger in different ways. You overturn a car when you're young, a sports car.
Yeah.
I hope you haven't eaten yet, but anyway, your ear is found in the in the road.
My ear was found in the road. This ear, actually.
That one, is it, right?
Not too bad, as years ago.
And they stitched it back on.
Before microsurgery.
And you almost lost one of your hands, which...
Left hand.
That one, yeah.
Still crushed. I mean, still distorted.
Yeah.
But that was a lucky one. I mean, lucky to survive.
Yeah, you were lucky to survive that one. There's one where you're in an aeroplane and a bullet goes... when I say between your legs, not quite, sort of between your knees rather than between your legs.
Yeah, well, it was close. Yeah, horrendous. I mean, I was sitting on a crate of mortars. In the back of an gunrunner plane, going into Biafra, and we flew over Guinea-Bissau, which was then Portuguese Guinea, and there was an independence war going on. So as this thing, Super Constellation, clapped out old freighter, drifted in over the undershoot area, which was jungle, some Amilcar Cabral's fine fellows fired upwards. And against all the odds, because hitting a moving plane is not easy. This one came up through the floor. I was sitting there with this crate of mortars here. And came up through the floor and out the ceiling. Thank you, whoever you are.
Well, that's the thing. But you see, as you know, people who've had these scrapes and got through them and they've had luck, it appears to be luck. Some people say luck, some people say fate, chance, destiny, all those things.
Well,
where do you stand on that?
I always say luck. Mm. I mean, some pieces of good luck came to me which were to my advantage, and others just got me out of a scrape, which I probably wouldn't have been in if I hadn't been stupid about going into things that I didn't know enough about. Curiosity, I've always had this huge bump of curiosity, probably why I became a journalist. If I can't see a lid without wanting to lift it and find out what's underneath it, or a closed box without wanting to open it and see what's inside, take that into a political arena, and you might say, there's a war going on. I really have got to see what's going on there, which I did, and then thought, I wish I hadn't come here. So, I mean, there's a story about that South African mercenary who's in the middle of the jungle, miles from anywhere, next to a 6'2" psychopath who's armed to the teeth. And he suddenly, he said in this thick accented South African accent, "A bit, I'm the only person around this campfire who can prove he's sane." There were three other mercs there, and we all lay there in the darkness thinking there's only one way you can prove you're sane, that's if you've got a certificate. The only way you can get a certificate is when they're let out of a lunatic asylum. So I thought, I lay there thinking, oh, struth, what am I doing? What am I doing here? You know, he's mad as a frog. He could kill us all, we never know. No one will ever know if we die here. I wasn't worried about the others, I was a bit worried about me dying. But he didn't. But on the way back from that particular mission, I made sure to march behind him in case he forgot about his little sanity chit.
But you seem to have no sense of danger or fear. Because I mean, you lie about your age to get into the RAF.
You can mock things like that 40 years later.
I'm not mocking them. I'm not mocking
no,
them.
No, I am.
Hey, you are, right, okay.
I mean, but things were scary at the time, are funny now.
Yeah, but I'm interested in why you did them at the time. So at the time when... almost everyone, as you say, was trying to get out of national service because it was rumoured to be ending anyway. Mm. You lied about your age to get into it.
Yeah, but I just had this obsession about aeroplanes. Right. Right from childhood in Kent, back in the 1944, I had this formless obsession with not just aeroplanes but fighters. I just desperately wanted to be a fighter pilot. I didn't want to fly freight aircraft or bombers. I just had to be. All my whole playroom wasn't pop star. We didn't have pop stars then. It wasn't even sportsmen. No, I think Dennis. What's his name? Brooklyn. Dennis Compton. Yes, and Stanley Matthews came later. At the time, the walls were papered with fighter aces. First World War and Second World War. They were the heroes, and I just said, I'm going to be one day. I'm going to be like that. And it just didn't die. The dream didn't die. So all through my teens, I just chased this ideal of getting into the Air Force. So, yes, you're quite right. When I was 17, chafing at the bit, impatient to wait till my 18th birthday, which was the legal age for entry, I kept bombarding the Air Force to try and let me in. Eventually wangled it. It was a wangle, there's no question about it. It should not have happened. It was just influence. It was a very unbureaucratic age. People did wangle things back then in the 50s without too much form filling. All right, lad, yeah, get in. You know. Here's a uniform, put it on.
And more recently, there you are. More recently, flying.
Yeah, well, that was
flying again.
That was the other dream, you see. I mean, because in 44, a fighter was a Spitfire for me. It was a Spitfire, but what I didn't know was the jet age was coming. So by the time I got in, they were jets. But I still had this dream one day to fly a Spitfire, and then last summer, I was 76 years old. The phone rang, and someone said, "Are you the fellow who wants to fly a Spitfire?" So I said, "Yeah." He said, "Are you available tomorrow?" I said, I've been available for 70 years. So they said, "Well, if you'd like to come down to Headcorn, Lashenden Airfield, we've got one coming in with a second cockpit. And for a certain donation to our rebuilding fund, we might be able to arrange for you to fly in it." So, of course, there I was. And yes, it came in. It came in from Uxford. And it was I think there's only four in the country. There are a lot of Spitfires in the country now. They're not replicas, they're restorations, but about four have had a second cockpit added for passengers. So I was plunked into it, and yes, we took off, and about 3,000 feet over the Weald of Kent, Cliff Spink, who was up front, I just saw his hands through two layers of perspex coming down, and the voice said, "It's all yours." Yeah. Wow, me, a Spitfire. A Mark 9, restored, obviously, with the second cockpit, dual controls. And so my dream came true. A dream I formed when I was a little boy of five.
Wow. I'd just like, before we take questions, you talk about laughing at things in the past. I mean, you remain incredibly optimistic in the account you give throughout the book. There's a chapter where you're writing the first chapter, I think, of The Deceiver, and you get a phone call saying that you've lost most of your money.
All of it, yes.
No, in a scam, yeah.
I'd invested, not in, but through, an asset advisor, asset manager, guy who advises you on the best portfolios to buy. But he hadn't. He was a swindler. I didn't know it. I thought he was a personal friend. He turned out he was a ruthless swindler who got personally into trouble and just embezzled his client's money to try and get out of trouble. It didn't save him eventually because the fraud squad came calling and the whole, Ponzi scheme?
Yes.
Collapsed. So the fraud squad called me in and they said, "I think you should come in and have a chat with us." So I did. And they said, do you think you have a, very comfortable little pension pot invested with this guy?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you don't. We've been through all the files, and it's all been forged. It's all gone." So I thought, "Struth." I might have said "Struth," but I probably said something else, as one would.
Except that in the book, you see, here's an example. I talked about your punchy economical style. End of that chapter. "Anyway, I had made up my mind that there was only one thing for it. That was, at the age of 50, to write a series of more novels and make it all back. Full stop. So I did, full stop."
Yeah.
But there must, when it happens, it must hit you more than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a punch in the stomach. I've often been intrigued by, there are ladies present, how defensive women can be when their man is hurt. Much more vengeful, I mean, we are, because my dearly beloved said, "I want you to go back into your past and find a mercenary and put a contract out on him." That's no doubt. First of all, I can't afford it.
No, that's true. Yeah.
Secondly, I might take a human life for other reasons, but not for that. Not money.
Okay, if we could bring the lights up. And a gentleman already, yes, would like to
I thought I'd better read one of your books.
Ah.
the Afghan, as it happens, yep. And it's a fascinating book. Two things, really. One is that you describe a spanner in the works that meant that the most intricate plan was in bits on the floor. And I imagine that's real life, isn't it?
It can be.
And the other thing is this. It's about, without going into the plot, obviously, it's about infiltration into the inner circle of a terrorist group.
Yeah.
And I wonder to what extent that is still a live strand of espionage, or call it what you will, in these days of drones, where really it's all at very much not just at arm's length, but at country miles length, isn't it? Without the personal contact at all.
True.
I just wondered if you had thoughts about that.
Yes, the fact is that with espionage since 1945, the Americans obviously have vast, by our standards, budgets. So we cannot match them. The NRO, which is, few people have heard of the National Reconnaissance Office, all those spies in the sky, those satellites with cameras pointed down, we can't match that. The NSA, the National Security Agency, which is their GCHQ, their listening post, we can't match the sheer staggering size of their budgets. So what we bring to the table is human intelligence. We have always been, I said, since Sir Francis Wolsey, rather good at listening to other people through the wainscoting. That's what he used to do anyway. Now we do it other ways. And the best way of getting inside the thinking processes of an enemy organization is to infiltrate somebody. And of course, it's now getting harder and harder. That book was written about when it was thought Al-Qaeda was our main enemy. Well, now we've probably been superseded by ISIL.
That's right.
But it's not... Infiltrating even the KGB... might be possible if you have a Russian speaker who could pass for Russian or probably was Russian. But getting somebody into these organizations, there is no way you're going to get a phony in. Why? Because, obviously, we don't look the same. It's very complicated language. But more to the point, in the Arabian society, you come from a village, and it's easy to check that you were truly born the son of Ibrahim and Layla, and you were raised in that village, and that's you. So a phony is extremely hard.
Presumably there's also an ethical point, is there, that if you have organisations who are using suicide bombers, you can't... Can you send in an agent who might be required to...
Well, he would have to be ethnically of that group.
No, but ethically, though, could you send someone in who might be asked to be a suicide bomber?
Well, he could always refuse. It's not compulsory. I mean, usually the suicide bombers are very young and they're raised from childhood, almost boyhood, in a madrasa to believe that it is a glorious end to give their lives for Allah. But the commanders don't do that. They send the kids to do it, but they don't know it themselves. So if you're going to infiltrate, say, ISIL, you're going to need a Sunni Muslim born and raised in that territory. In other words, you're going to need what for them would be a renegade. Yes. That's the only way you can do it. This was an attempt to get a British man, who had been born and raised in Iraq, of an oil executive father, but who'd been sent to an Arabic school, an Iraqi school, who could pass for Iraqi among Iraqis. To see if he could infiltrate Al Qaeda, a long shot, nearly worked.
Well, you're very persuasive in the book, but it doesn't really quite stack up.
It's been done twice, I can tell you that. So it's not entirely unprecedented. Normally, if you want an infiltrator, you recruit someone who is already inside, like Oleg Penkovsky, who was a brigadier of the GRU. Was recruited by the British in Moscow, and he spied against the Soviet Union. Oleg Penkovsky was just living a few miles away in Buckinghamshire. He's now an elderly man, but Oleg was, he was a KGB colonel, and we recruited him. But he was he didn't have to pretend to be a Russian. He didn't have to pretend to be KGB. He was.
Mm.
And that's the best way to do it.
And the thing that we now know, it's been widely reported and proven that it happened with environmental groups and left-wing groups, of police infiltrating to the extent of having relationships with people and fathering children. Would in the espionage business, would it ever go that far?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah. In fact, you know, with Oleg, I mean Penkovsky. Gordievsky.
Gordievsky.
He had to leave his wife and daughter behind. He had to get out of Moscow. We got him out of Moscow in a hurry. He's realized that his cover was blown, that he was going to be picked up, probably tortured, to confession level, and then executed. And we had to get him out of Moscow, which we did, in a covert operation, to the Finnish border, and then of course into Finland, then free. I mean, an RAF jet out of Helsinki airport back to the UK. But he left his wife and his daughter behind, and he knew that would have to happen. Later they divorced, and that was the end of that.
Anyone over on this side? Yes.
Hi. Not so much a question, more of a comment. The Spitfire tale that you just recounted actually reflects on a few of the aspects you've mentioned in the rest of the talk. Those double-seaters weren't later conversions. They were actually designed for that.
Yeah.
The designers were originally coming up with that design during the height of the Battle of Britain, but the War Office cancelled it, saying no one has crashed on their first flight. We don't need these. However, after the war, when Johnny Foreigner in the Empire got the plane sent out to their air forces, they actually felt that they needed trainers, whereas the plucky Brits during the war had actually learned to fly themselves with minimal training.
Yeah, some guys went into combat with 6-7 hours on type. They didn't... I mean, actually, if I'm correct, just one, the Spitfire was developed before the war. R.J. Mitchell designed the Spitfire, and it was built by Supermarine. A couple of prototypes were built. It took a long time to get MOD approval for it as a type. They preferred the Hurricane. But eventually they did concede to grant an order for a quite small number of Spitfires. But the reports coming in were that it was so, unmatchable, that we needed more. We had just enough in time for the Battle of Britain, but only just enough. But it was and remains a superlative fighter, and now it's iconic because of the role it performed in a period of our history, which most people accept, even who didn't live through it, was the hinge on which we survived as a people or didn't survive as a people. So there it is, the Spit.
Well, there's a chilling line in the book on the subject of the design of a plane. When you're doing your RAF training at the beginning and somebody points out, someone points out it's got no ejector seat.
The Vampire, the Vampire single seat jet.
And the reason they're told, that's right, came the sardonic reply from the senior NCO, no one has ever escaped from a dying Vampire, you either fly in it or die in it.
Yep. It was the only jet we ever sent into the air with no ejector seat. And the reason was it was designed along with the Meteor in the dying days of the war before the invention of the Mark Baker ejector seat. So when Mr. Mark Baker had designed his ejector seat, which obviously is a lifesaver, they could fit one into the Meteor. There was enough space, but they couldn't fit one into the Vampire. So the Vampire went on as a frontline fighter, which you couldn't get out of. You just literally couldn't get out of it. If you got into trouble and it began to fall out of the sky, you got the canopy off and stood up, two things happened. Firstly, your parachute pack jammed into the rear of the seat and the gun sight jammed into your solar plexus, and then the wind bent you backwards and snapped your spine. So you had to go back in. But if once back in, you were going to die anyway. So no one ever got out of a Vampire. You landed it, or you died in it.
anyone? Yes, sir.
I just wondered, are there any stories that you've researched and then either been warned off or scared off pursuing?
I've never actually knowingly, or I think I actually never put anything seriously dangerous in any of those novels, because I'm pretty certain I know and either it's technically too dangerous to reveal to the public how it's done, like a bomb, or even a trigger for a explosive device, or it's somewhere in that rather the world that James Jesus Angleton called a world of smoke and mirrors, where it might be a piece of tradecraft that is still being used. If it's purely archival, which I think this is, which is why I say I don't think any harm can be done now, because it's all gone. There is no East Germany, there is no Stasi, and what's called tradecraft. I checked up that nothing I mentioned there is being used anymore. It's all blown. It's archival. But even writing all the novels for the past 40 years, if ever I came near that area, I would just take those sheets for four or five, perhaps. And I always write, I'm afraid, still on white paper. I mean, A4 sheets of paper, and bung them down to a friend who would take them to a certain office, and they'd come back a week later. Freddie, old boy, don't mention this and this. The rest's okay. So this would be cut out.
So how much would they take out generally? I mean.
It's just if it was in any way hazardous, if it was a piece of tradecraft that was still being used. There was one story I wrote where I got a gem, which I didn't know whether it was allowable or not. It was in Ireland. Whenever an IRA man was killed or blown up by his own bomb or shot by the security forces. The IRA leaders used to take the occasion of his funeral as a place and a time where they could meet. And what they would do was they would lean over the coffin and murmur confidences to each other right above the coffin. So we bugged the coffins. And I thought, Jesus, so they would be leaning forward. And went, well, you're going to do the pub tomorrow night, are we? Oh, yes, we are indeed. Yes. And there's a guy in the hill with him. I'm going to do the same pub tomorrow. Right? And it worked for a while, and then I think something went weak, static, from the coffin. Anyway, it was discontinued. So I asked if that was still used, and they said, well, it's done no harm now, we don't do it anymore. So I used it, I mean, as an indication of the fun we used to have.
Although, as you've discovered, you can't be too careful, because the fact you say how important assets are to British Secret Service, that could lead people to look for assets.
I think it's been done. I think it's. Don't forget, there's an awful lot that's either been written. Two directors general of MI5 have written their memoirs.
One writes
six novels. Six is much more quiet. Mm. And there are the purists who say, you know, never, even under death, do you reveal the name of the tea lady. Well, I think that's going a bit far. Her name was Gladys, and she did a bloody good cup of tea. But it doesn't matter anymore. If there's anything that I was even slightly suspicious might still be usable, either by friend or foe, it wouldn't be in there.
Anyone on that? Yes, madam.
Just one little question. Would you like to see this book in film?
Would you like
to see this book in film?
I don't.
And perhaps you being the actor that is in the last scene of the Spitfire.
I don't think it would be feasible because it covers 75 years. Mm. You'd need at least four actors, one about that high, and then the elderly man, who of course would have to be George Clooney. I wish, but you know, I don't think it would work. It's not because it's not really a story. It's just a hell of a lot of incidents and episodes, and you need a story with a film, as you do with a novel, beginning, middle, end.
But you've made a dream come true.
Yeah. Okay. But you couldn't really make a whole movie about a guy dreaming of flying a Spitfire and then finally having 10 minutes. At the controls. I mean,
I'm sure they could. But
that's an episode.
No, I think it's a really interesting question, though. Because I don't think you perhaps realise this. I think you have shaped it as a narrative, you know, because I think you're so used to doing it. So it leads. There is a narrative in which you learn the languages, that gets you into journalism, that gets you into writing the novels. becoming an asset and then flying the Spitfire. Yeah, I think you do it automatically. It has a narrative shape.
I didn't intend. I mean, they said, you know, this is going to be an autobiography, and I always said, no, I'm not doing an autobiography, because that is, I think, a pin-accurate work, which is a reference book later, and it's got to be exactly what happened, and it's got to be all that happened. I took the view that there have been times when friends and I have been sitting around the dinner table, the wine has flowed, and it comes to the moment of swapping stories. And sometimes someone would say to me, you should write that down. And I thought, no. And then eventually I thought, well, why not? But I'll write it as 50 anecdotes. They're not linked to each other, although sometimes they're sequential, but they're not really linked. And there's certainly, those 350 pages cover 75 years, which is, what, 4 pages a year max. So, no, I don't think it's a novel. It's just a story of life in episodes or anecdotes.
No, I think it's a narrative, not a novel. But I was going to ask you, you just come back from America promoting it. There have been lots of stories of
the cigarette.
Cigarettes not being allowed on the covers of American books anymore. Has that happened to you with this?
No, oddly enough, the American one has a silhouette with a burning cigarette. But what I've tried with unavailingly to tell the publishers was that I stopped smoking about 20 years ago. So that, well, a good-looking young man has long passed on.
But it's very Ian Fleming, that pose, isn't it?
He used to do it. Well, I think Patrick Litchfield took that.
Mm.
Maybe not. Anyway, is it credit? No, doesn't.
No.
No. Well. They did. The publishers did a huge amount of research for the pictures. I could provide a few, but they found pictures I'd long forgotten. So they did a lot of work trying to find out pictures, and including that one. It must have been 20 something years ago.
Mm.
I remember it was about 40, 44 yen then.
Mm.
As opposed to the sad old 77-year-old you see before you.
Okay, well, we're almost through. Anyone?
You were talking about your plots and how you actually have the end in mind and you have one draft. I wonder how much importance character has for you then in that case.
Sorry, how much what?
Character.
Yeah, no, not a lot.
Well, you said earlier that you cardboard characters, you accept them.
I've been accused of cardboard, cut-out cardboard characters, which could be. Yes, because I don't spend a lot of time on the development of the character. It's probably half a page. What he is, where he is, where he came from, how he got into this line of business, and that's about it. If he fell in love with his rocking horse at the age of 4, I don't give a stuff. I just don't. So I'm not certain that the reader will either, so I don't dwell on it. Just what happens next is the big question. And hopefully is to find that out that you don't turn the page.
Although, interestingly, your subconscious turned this to your advantage. Because in the day of the jackal, the fact that the character is a blank is the point, isn't it? We don't even know his name.
No, there was Harold Harris, who was the very shrewd, I would say that, wouldn't I? Editorial director of Hutchinson's, when I went to him in 1970. He looked at me rather bemusedly, and he said, "I've never read a novel. I'm going to take a flyer on this." This was after I'd been turned down by 4 others. He said, "I'm going to take a flyer on this because I'll publish it with a limited number of copies, 5,000, I think, was the launch print." But he said, "It is odd. It's the oddest book I've ever read because I've never read a novel before where the principal character, hero, protagonist, what he called, has no name." Even if he's mysterious at the beginning, he's always exposed by the end. Certainly he doesn't go to his grave anonymous, but this one does. Secondly, I've never seen a book where real characters conversed with fictional characters without, I suppose, complaining. And I've never seen such an obsession with technical accuracy. I mean, the machine, how does this machine work? What gun? Not just a gun, which gun? What caliber? Made by whom? So he said, on those three levels, I think it odd. But it might work.
There was a fourth one, wasn't there? Because young people now don't know whether de Gaulle was shot or not. But at that stage, people knew the assassination.
That was right. It was being turned down all the time because it was, he was still alive. De Gaulle was still retired at Colombie, Les Églises. He died in November 70. I was hawking this around the West End in the spring of 70. So I had just, if I may, on a light note, a couple of years ago, a young guy came up to me and someone mentioned my name. He said, are you the you that fellow, that wrote that? I said, Joe the Jackal? Because it's always there. That's it, I said, I just read that. He said, that's amazing. God, you must have a hell of an imagination. I said, well, that's very kind of you. He said, how anybody could invent a character like Charles de Gaulle, I do not know. Well, he was 22. I mean, it's been two generations.
And the fact that de Gaulle conveniently died while you were hawking the manuscript round, you didn't put a hit out on him by any chance?
Sorry, who?
De Gaulle died while you were...
Oh, no, he never read it. But Jacques Malraux read it. He'd been his culture minister. And it was probably he who got it off the ground in France because he wrote a letter to Mercure de France, which was my publisher then, saying, this is exactly the de Gaulle I remember so well and served. Up till then, the French reaction had been, c'est anglais, mentioning our Le Grand Charles, how dare he. After that letter, it was okay. It took off in France in quite a big way.
Actually, quite a good story you could end on is the story of his Corsican bodyguard when they're shaking hands.
Oh, that happened. Yeah, I was there. He de Gaulle used to do these provincial tours. And it was said that he was very, very distant. But he was with the great and the good, but he liked the people. And although he once said, of course, it's impossible to govern a country that produces 444, whatever it is, types of cheese. But he did like the French people. He did not like the French establishment. The politicians and people like that. But he used to take these foreign tours, provincial tours, and he would suddenly stop the car. You'd tap the driver on the shoulder and say, arrêtez. The car would stop, and he'd open the door to the rage and bewilderment of his bodyguards and step outside and then walk into the crowd. He called it la bain de foule, the bath in the crowd. I mean, now it's compressing the flesh, and yes, all politicians think they have to do it, but it was rather new then, and particularly when the man with the price on his head, practically, he'd sentenced to death by the cream of the French army. He worried the hell out of his bodyguards. But on one particular bath in the crowd, he was striding forward, saying, alors, oui, votez pour moi, bonjour, votez pour moi. And he gripped this man's hand and shook it. Short, swarthy fellow. He had myopia. Not the bodyguard, thank God, but de Gaulle. But he was too vain to put specs on. So even reading, he would memorize the whole text and pretend to read it. And his press conferences were like that. He would pretend to recognize the man from Le Monde or the man from François or something and say, oui, oui, monsieur Antel. So I couldn't see him. He's a blur. But anyway, on this particular bath in the crowd, about 5 or 10 paces later, same little man, squat, saturnine, bonjour, bonjour. The third time, the fellow leaned up to him and said, Monsieur le Président, will you please, and he did use the F word, he said, will you please stop the F shaking my hand? It's my gun hand, I'm your bodyguard.
That's one of the many fantastic stories in The Outsider, My Life in Intrigue by Frederick Forsyth. Thank you very much to all of you and also to him.
Thank you indeed. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.